This podcast is brought to you by Lanco Group, your business partner for engineering solutions. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR Football Nation Radio.
Hello, I'm your host, Louise Taffer, with Nick DiBano joining me here in the studio. It's great to have your company this evening. We've got plenty to get through, including all the results overnight from the FIFA Women's World Cup. We'll also touch on some of the transfer news going on over in Europe and look at the results over there in some of the other competitions that are in action. And then we'll also have a guest joining us at 5:45 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time to talk about Italy and their cruel opening win against the Matildas. However you see it, you might see it is as a positive.
Well, for our Italian listeners out there, maybe those over in the Mediterranean might not see it as cruel, might see it as a bit of optimism. So I guess it depends what side of the argument you are, if you obviously come from the Australian point of view or the Italian point of view in that discussion.
I think as a neutral, it was pretty amazing.
A neutral?
Well, on this perspective, I think it was pretty amazing.
Yeah, I think it was great.
Like 20 years not featuring at the FIFA Women's World Cup, that's pretty amazing for them to win. And you know, let alone be there, be here at the tournament.
Yeah, and be joined, obviously, as you said, by Vito Doria from the Forza Italia Football Podcast, who their show features here on FNR Football Nation Radio. He's been on the show a few times, and we've spoken to him about all things Italian football. He'll talk to us a little bit about a bit of rejuvenation happening in Italy at the moment. The women are performing quite well. The men are on fire. The under-20 side made all the way to the semis, unfortunately lost this morning. And the under-21 side kick off their European competition kicking off next week. So they've got some exciting times at the moment happening after a bit of upheaval after their unceremonious non-qualification for the World Cup, obviously, in Russia.
Insigne's strike this morning.
Oh, boy.
Wow.
You couldn't have hit that any better. Like, I think that
amazing. I could watch that over and over and over.
I think if you hit that 100 times, 95 of them at least would probably go flying over the bar. But that was unbelievable. That's straight out of the training yard, that one. That great corner comes right to the edge of the box. Insigne hit that beautifully. Italy were on the back foot early. They were able to fight back and get that win against Bosnia. And we'll talk about that one a little bit later because there were some big results last night, Louise.
Yes, we'll talk about what that result means for Italy as well moving forward. But let's get straight into the FIFA Women's World Cup because there was one massive result. And the United States actually recorded their biggest ever victory in the FIFA Women's World Cup as they defeated Thailand 13-0.
It's 10. The USA into double figures. Is it going to be 13? It is.
With thanks to Optusport, yes, the United States defeated Thailand 13-0. The US are now top of Group F, and that result was just something else. I mean, Alex Morgan scored five times for the US, and we also saw the likes of Carly Lloyd chipping in and getting one of her own. She also earned her 275th cap for the US in that win against Thailand.
Unbelievable. In any sport to win in a World Cup game by that margin, it's absolutely baffling that that's the difference between the best in the world and the 34th best team in the world. And to think that, I think though, totally ruling out Thailand for the rest of the tournament. Like we've seen, it was actually one of our good friends, Rick D'Andrea, tweeted about it not long ago saying there's been big results. It's happened in World Cups all over history. We've seen 7-0 and 7-1 even in World Cup semis. But regardless of it, you've got to give the USA a lot of credit to win 13-0 and send a statement. That's the benchmark now. They've set the foot, they've set the tone of how what every team now needs to follow because they're going as the red-hot favourites now to take out the whole thing and rightfully so after a performance like that. Thailand, though, that is a big, big mountain to climb because even if you want to qualify as a third-ranked team, you need to have a bit of goal difference on your side. And I don't think they're going to be pegging back 13 goals in two games. That depending on, well, really what happens from here, that could even obviously get even higher. You know, that's the scary part, that their goal difference could even maybe eclipse 20 by the end of it.
So Thailand's second group game is against Sweden, who defeated Chile 2-0. Yep. And then their third group game is obviously against Chile, and that is Friday the 21st. So they have a little bit of work to do.
A bit.
But
more than just a bit. They got a lot.
That goes down as the biggest win in FIFA Women's World Cup history. 13-0 against Thailand. The second closest and second highest biggest win actually came in 2007 when Germany defeated Argentina 11-0.
Okay.
And then the third was Germany again defeating Ivory Coast this time in 2015, 10-0. So there are some big wins, but that one goes down as the biggest. I would have to say there has been quite a lot of backlash from this result.
Rightfully so.
I mean, if you're going to blow away another team, do it with a bit of humility.
Well, it's not even about a bit of humility. It's like in anything, if you've got a lead, I think even when you eclipse three goals and you go to 4-0, I think that's when you sort of put the arms up and you say, like, all right, like, we've got it. If you score, keep scoring goals. But to go and, like, rub it in their face and sort of do those big over-exuberant celebrations, acting like they've just scored a winner when they're actually 10, 11, 12-0 up at that point, just tone it down a little bit. I don't know if that's just they got a bit carried away. But then again, they're professionals. A lot of these players have been playing at World Cups for so long, and they are the reigning champions and experienced team. You'd expect from just to dial it back just a little bit when it got to those later stages when they were slamming on the goals and really taking advantage of it. So I think they scored 10 goals after halftime. I think it was 3-0 at halftime and then scored 10 after that. So even then, all their goals in the second half probably should have just been, you know, just sort of relax, take it easy. You know, they could have just sort of few high fives. Everyone gets around each other, but just a few high fives. Don't need to do the big.
But it's a bit tacky. I mean, Alex Morgan was basically counting out how many goals she had scored as a goal celebration. You don't need to do that. As you say, when you are beyond five, even beyond four, you just score a goal and get on with it.
Run back to the centre, pick up the ball and keep going. If you want to send a statement about getting goal difference, the biggest statement of that is actually going in, picking up the ball and running back and saying, okay, let's get our goal difference up, not rubbing it in the face of poor Thailand who have already suffered enough. Like, you know, there's the famous Simpson line that everyone uses for memes, like, stop, he's already dead. Like it's the same sort of analogy here, is that Thailand were done. Like, after halftime, it was 3-0. It was like, all right, now we can maybe rest some key players even in that situation. Get to 4-5-0 and then just say, okay, like, we're in a good position right now. Like, we can maybe get that goal difference up. Of course, you want to go for the kill. It's a great sign that the US were prepared to be relentless. But then just to rub it in and rub further salt in the wounds, I'm not for that.
It wasn't needed. And the Canadians in particular were absolutely furious. Kaylin Kyle, she made 101 caps for Canada. She said it was disrespectful and it was disgraceful. She actually even went further saying, hats off to Thailand. I'd love to be there just to give them all a hug.
Yeah. Well, here's what some of these Canadian pundits had to say.
Pew, but when you're Alex Morgan too and you're counting, it was the way in which they did it which is now sparking headlines. And Claire, I loved what you said. If you were going to blow away a team, do it with humility. And they did not. Megan Rapinoe has scored countless goals on the international stage. She was celebrating like she had her first. We can understand if it was a first goal like a Mallory Pew, but when you're Alex Morgan too and you're counting out your goals, it was just unacceptable.
Well, I understand there's a goal differential race in this tournament. I understand they're nervous about drawing Sweden later in the tournament, but this was disgraceful from the United States. I would have hoped they could have won with humility and grace, but celebrating goals 8, 9, 10, the way they were doing, is really unnecessary.
I'm all about passion, and I think as a Canadian, we would just never, ever think of doing something like that. We've played against the Americans before where you have a player of Christine Sinclair scoring three goals and she would never even think about counting how many goals she has on one hand. For me, it's disrespectful. It's disgraceful. I just, hats off to Thailand for holding their head high. I mean, their first time on a World Cup stage. I'd love to be there to just hug them all.
Yeah, the U.S. is fully capable of blowing out teams. And, of course, in the World Cup, you're not going to hold back. And maybe they have an internal target they want to meet or trying to break the record. But, I mean, it embarrasses the word for Jill Ellis, I think, the way she was leading her team in this one.
With thanks to Fox Sports, that was some of the pundits over there in Canada and former players chatting about the United States' massive win over Thailand and just how repulsive some of their celebrations were at that point in time after it had gone well beyond, you know, four goals. It had gone into 13, as we did end up seeing. And I'd just like to correct Kaylin Kyle, because it's not actually Thailand's first appearance at the FIFA Women's World Cup. It's their second. They've already appeared at the World Cup. But they are minnows. And, you know, I think that that scoreline is also a reflection on how far Thailand have to go, because it just shows you the quality of the US, but also where Thailand are at. And I actually think it's quite sad, because we need to be helping these other nations and try to bridge the gap for them as well in world football.
And that will come eventually in time. Maybe the way Thai football is with the women is maybe not at the same level in terms of funding and everything
and
else.
Resources.
Of course, that maybe the men have. It's a problem that happens throughout all of world football, and something that hopefully will change over time. And considering the Thai women's team are making World Cups, but the men aren't, I know the men are starting to come up a little bit in world football. They were quite impressive in the Asian Cup in some moments, even though they had their coach sacked halfway through the group stage. I think they could still, to a degree, as long as they can now bounce back in the next two games and show a little bit of spirit, they can hold their heads up high. Because I think the best case study to compare it to is when you look at maybe England when they played Panama at the last World Cup, when England were up big and they just sort of, even when they were slamming on the goals, were just very relax in their celebrations after it got past two or three. They just sort of, as we said, put their hands up. They still got around each other, but it wasn't anything like going, oh, we're 6-0 up,
you
know,
face.
Count the fingers, rub it in the poor players' faces. Just tone it down. I think that, honestly, that's going to probably maybe motivate some of the other teams now, because I think that, to a degree, that could almost be a statement to other teams in a way, because they're now saying, look what we can do. See what you guys can do better. They're sending a statement to teams like the Matildas, your France, your Germanys, those big nations, England, and are saying, all right, like, look what we did to Thailand. We're playing some mind games with you. When it gets to the knockout stage, I want to see if some of these teams start to, you know, give it back a little bit. I want to see some fireworks, really add some intrigue getting into as we pass the group stage.
Yeah, I would love to see that. And look, to be honest, I'm going to be straightforward here. I don't want to see the United States win the Women's World Cup. I would much, after that performance, after what they showed, I would much rather see any other country win the FIFA Women's World Cup other than the United States. So I'm not going for them at all.
Well, yeah, I understand that. At the end of the day, look, we have to still, you have to give them credit. Like, for me, it is obviously disheartening, but I still give them the credit. This team is a fantastic team. They're a joy to watch. Regardless of what they did, I respect them for what they do on the field, because you have to respect how good they are as players. But in terms of how they carried themselves, not so much. So I understand where you're coming from, but I want to see the best teams make it far. So as long as the US are going deep into the tournament and we see them playing the same level of football, as long as they're not blowing out teams every time, we see some really exciting games, and
I'm sure we will.
Well, they'll play next Monday against Chile. So I think that Chile, coming off their loss against Sweden, will be looking to really bounce back.
They'll be pretty hungry.
Yeah, and look, they had that 2-0 loss against Sweden. Sweden have an opportunity to qualify with a win over Thailand. They'll be safe in the top two if they can get the job done.
Elsewhere at the FIFA Women's World Cup in Group F, we saw the Olympic runners-up Sweden get off to a winning start in their campaign as they ended Chile's resistance in a 2-0 win.
We don't have the goals for that one just yet, Louise, but in saying that, still, it's a very, very solid result. You know, regardless of it, I heard it was really blustery conditions. Like, it wasn't.
Yeah, there was a lightning storm in the second half that saw the players taken off the pitch for about 40 minutes.
Well, Sweden were dominant, 24 shots to 5, and it took them all the way into the last 10 minutes of the game to finally break down a Chile resilience. So it's good to show that at least Chile are playing almost the armoured tortoise-like of Women's World Cup football, of sitting back and defending and frustrating, because I think they're going to have to try and do that against the US if they're not going to be able to obviously take the game to them. But for Sweden, it's a good bit of confidence. It's a nice win for them, obviously getting 3 points. It's the best way to start, and they're in a really good position now to get through to the next stage.
And the other game that was played, the Netherlands, they're expected to go a long way in the FIFA Women's World Cup, and they too began their campaign with a late 1-0 victory over New Zealand.
Van Dongen. And they have scored late on, a winner by Miedemar.
Yes, with thanks to Optus Sport, 1-0, the Netherlands win over New Zealand.
You got a feel for New Zealand. It was a cracking, cracking game. And they stuck it to them. They've got the all-star coach in Tom Samani there. And unfortunately, I think unfortunately, they weren't able to get at least the point out of this game. The Netherlands, though, probably should have won by so much more. They were playing quite well, and they were able to steal it through Jill Roord right at the end in the last couple of minutes. So a deserved win for the Netherlands, but I think New Zealand would be kicking themselves they weren't able to at least get a point, considering they were so close to doing just that.
Yeah, and they really frustrated the Netherlands, didn't they? I mean, then you could say Arsenal's Vivian Miedema could have had a couple herself, but, you know, I think it puts it in perspective. Doesn't matter where you are ranked, whichever country shows up on the day is who's going to win it. And I think that I think New Zealand could pose a threat to some of the other countries in that group. They have Canada and also Cameroon. So it'll be interesting to see how they go. Of course, we know that Tommy Simani is very competitive.
He is. And this is what he had to say after the game.
Look, happy with the performance right throughout the game. You know, I think we were courageous, battled hard, unbelievably disciplined, and gave everything we could give. And you know, tactically, the players did everything we asked from them. And
New Zealand head coach Tom Simani chatting there after the game, and his side are ranked 19th in the world, 11 places behind the Netherlands. But as I said, FIFA rankings to me don't really mean anything.
They never do. They really never do, to be honest. Like, in all reality, we've seen so many teams that play such great football that are lower in rankings, and teams that win games in those meaningless friendlies and just surge up the rankings. I think there needs to be a bit of a overhaul in the way those rankings work. But as we have a look, Canada, New Zealand, that's the next meeting for those two teams, and Netherlands play Cameroon. So it's going to be interesting to see how this group pans out, because Canada got a gutsy 1-0 win over Cameroon. So though that second group games are going to be quite interesting, I think that potentially the third place team might progress in that group. So I reckon it's quite a strong one. And maybe New Zealand might sneak through as a second or third place team, but I'm thinking the Netherlands are shaping up to probably be a team that will more than likely top this group.
New Zealand have never actually won a FIFA Women's World Cup game. So
I think to say it, we want our neighbours to do well.
I think they're very hungry. You can imagine the hunger within that team. They want to get 3 points.
Yeah, rightfully so. Rightfully so. I think it's time that they do. And obviously, we'll be cheering on our guys across the ditch, hoping that they can get the job done. And hopefully, you know, because the men, they've never been able to get a win either. So I think that it's about time that we could see the women potentially staking the claim as we head into the second match day. Just moving on for just a second, Louise, I got some news today regarding the Matildas. I don't know if you saw this just before we came on, but there's some injury news. Three players in doubt for the game against Brazil, which it doesn't sound good at all. And one in particular, which is worrying me, is Claire Polkinghorne, because Australia have no other centre-backs in their department. They have no one else that's ready to come in that plays as a natural centre-back.
No. So and what they would have to do is
Steph Catley, probably.
Well, or Elise Kellen-Knight. So in the friendly against Argentina, we saw Kellen-Knight come into centre-back for, you know, 10 minutes or so. And Ante Milicic was just flirting with the idea of other players being versatile. But hopefully Claire can be fit for this crucial, crucial clash against Brazil. Because if we don't get 3 points, they're not progressing through out of the group stage.
Oh, no, they're not.
And that would be a massive fail. That's a fail, Mark.
I wouldn't say that they're definitely not going to go through. But
as
a good position, that's the main thing.
There's
you don't
a
want
lot
to go
riding on other results for them to get through with these third place teams, right?
No.
So still, it's not good enough. They will need to get 3 points against Brazil, which is going to be very difficult. Very difficult with the class that Brazil have.
And I have still a lot of concerns about the Matildas. Like, I was very disappointed in terms of just that defensive setup. I know I've spoken so much about it. I'm not going to harp on too much about it. But better teams, no disrespect to Italy, but better teams would make that scoreline much worse, because Italy had about, what, 3 or 4 disallowed goals?
Well, they scored 4 goals.
Yeah. And in reality, in serious reality, there's talk about offside traps and timing your runs and everything else. For better strikers, for better teams, Brazil, USA, they would make sure those runs are on, and they would be doing their research on what to expect from Australia defence. Especially the US, they just recently came up against Australia. I have my concerns. I asked Josh Parris his exact same question on Friday. I said, is it concerning that the Matildas have not won in their last 3 games heading into the World Cup? And he said, no. I think it's just get it out of the system. It's all good. They'll be fine when they get to the World Cup. I think that's carried over. I think there's a bit of concern at the moment.
Because you can't change these things overnight.
No, you're
they
not.
Take months. And it's also, you've got to be willing to change, right? So we've identified that there were weaknesses in defence, but also weaknesses in midfield, which have to be rectified before the next game. I think that the starting 11 needs to be tweaked to one or two players. Keller Knight has to come
and
in.
Probably Katrina Gary
has to come into the fold if she's fit. But it's really interesting that we talk about this because it comes down to the one percenters of big tournaments like this. Mm. Now, at times, and it sounds really crazy that I'm actually going to say this, but at times the Matildas lack the cutting edge in the final third, right? So realistically now, there's only been one game at the Women's World Cup, but that wasn't even scored from open play.
No, it was a penalty.
We are struggling sometimes to score from open play.
Technically it was open play, but I understand where you're coming from. It wasn't open play.
It was penalty.
If you want to talk technicalities, it was. But I understand. Don't worry. I get you. I'm just being a bit of a smart ass.
We need more goals from open play. And on top of that, they need to be converting every chance that is posed to them. I mean, you can say we've had as many crosses in as possible, but that means nothing. Unless they're going into the back of the net, then the Matildas won't be progressing out of this group, let alone making a semi or a quarterfinal.
Well, that's the one thing we all said. The pass mark is to go deep. Get out of the group now. That's the worrying thing. And I'm looking at potentially some changes. If Devanna and also Caitlin Ford are out, you lose arguably your best attacking option off the bench, and you lose Caitlin Ford from the starting 11, which probably does mean Katrina Gorry comes straight in. It's almost a no-brainer. I think we might see Emily Gilnick get an opportunity off the bench. I would have liked to have seen her come on in that game. I don't know why she didn't. I thought that she could have definitely added something. And I think at least for 20 minutes against Brazil off the bench, he could really add a bit of X factor. But look, I think it'd be more concerning if they don't come out and win against Brazil and don't actually show a bit because, it could be just brushing off the cobwebs of the first game against Italy, sort of caught out by a team that they don't know too much about. But there still are a lot of signs for concern at the moment when it comes to the Matildas. They just need to make sure they're getting the ball to Sam Kerr because she barely got on the ball as well. I know that We've harped on so much about this game, but you got to get the ball to your best player, and Sam Kerr wasn't getting on the ball.
But if your best player is being heavily marked and nullified, it's
a
responsibility on other players in the team to press collectively and try and score goals.
It's also about...
which they're capable of.
The fact is they were pressing as well, but the thing is, how much can you press against a team that's going to counterattack you and leave your defence exposed, which the Matildas proved they're their biggest liability is when their back four is exposed. So that's where you do bring in a player like Callan Knight to sit in the hole and play that role as a negator. You need to get the ball to Kerr. So Kerr might have to change her game in terms of coming in deeper, picking up the ball and bringing other players into the game.
Whether or not Ante wants her to do that is another question.
That's a whole other story because Sam Kerr's game is not just being a player that can play off the shoulder. She's got so much more to her game. She's a hungry player that's willing to get on the ball at times and provide for other players. You've got Razzo, you've got Ford, you've got Gorry. If Devanna's fit or Gilnick, you've got players that can also score goals. Like, there doesn't just have to be Sam Kerr off the shoulder. You've got to trust in those other players as well. So if it means if Kerr has to potentially make a new role to create space for others, that might be a potential thing that Ante Milicic might look at when they play against Brazil. But in saying that, Australia have matched up very well against Brazil in the past. It was a different Australia under Alan Stajic, so I don't want to read too much into that, but it's obviously something they could take a bit of confidence in heading into the second group game. Because if they win, then we might be starting to talk about them, you know, we might not be talking too much about the negatives, we'll be looking more towards the positives of going deep in the tournament.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if you are joining us, we're talking about some of the Matildas' injury news because we have heard from Ante Milicic today that Claire Polkinghorne, Caitlin Ford and Lisa Devanna have all picked up issues in that loss against Italy. He's confident that all three, though, will recover before they face the South Americans. But they were only able to walk laps, is what we're being told. Mary Fowler didn't also train with the main group in that session in Montpellier, but she showed enough that she's progressing from her issue as well.
No attacking option never hurts.
No, and she's another player who could provide spark off the bench.
Of course. And they need as many, obviously, options as they can. They need to be less predictable, I think. They need to try some new things. As I said, if it means Sam Kerr coming in a bit deeper, it's still, like, in my opinion as well, we speak a lot about the Matildas' inefficiencies in that game. But the one thing that I know we're going to talk to Vitor about later is Italy's, how good they were. Because, you know, I heard talk about, you know, Barbara Bonacetta being not necessarily spoken up as a great player, but she was unbelievable.
I don't think anyone has the right to discredit her abilities. I don't think it's fair to also say, I heard pundits on other shows saying that the Matildas made her look good and that she actually isn't good at all.
It's a massive slap in the face.
I think that's pretty offensive
because
she is a quality player. And also, we can't forget that in qualifying, Italy only conceded 4 goals. It also is a reflection on how strong they are defensively.
Yeah, you know, Sara Gamma in defence is an absolute rock, and she proved it. She was absolutely fantastic with Linardi in centre-back, and the midfield was great. The attacking setup was fantastic. The intent was there to frustrate Australia on the counter-attack, and they were absolutely peppering them. Like, in that second half, Italy were a completely different team to what they showed in the first half. They probably should have been. They were, I reckon, the better team in the first half as well. You know, the only player getting forward for Australia in some bits was Ali Carpenter and really showing a bit of drive. I think that, as we said about Italy, is that they've got so many weapons, and Mauro showed it. You had Ghirelli as well. Sabatino off the bench and Giacinti were absolutely brilliant. That this Italy team, I reckon that this team could potentially go deep. There is no reason why they can't.
They'll make it out of the group.
Oh, 100%. But they could top the group. There's no reason why they can't. And this is a really good sign for Italy because, you know, Italy, as we said, Italy's women's team has been 20 years and there was a lot of motivation, a lot of just to stamp their ground. This is a lot, not just for the women of Italian football, for Italian football in general. For the last 2 years, it's been ridicule, 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 ridicule at the fact that the men's national team didn't get through. There's problems with the club level, like Juventus didn't perform in the Champions League and all this other stuff completely overshadowed. So this was like a statement. And I know the celebrations in Italy were unbelievable. The Italian community were absolutely buzzing with this result because it's very rare we hear, as we said, much coming out of the women's team. But this is, I think, a really cool result. Like, even me being as an Australian, you can't help but feel, when you take your I wouldn't say biased, but like that
the rose-coloured glasses.
Exactly. And you look at it from a neutral point of view, you've got to say, you know what, good on them. Like, good on them. And
well, let's look at Barbara Bonacea. She's 27 and she was the striker that converted.
Plays for Juventus.
That's exactly right. And has already had 37 appearances, scored 32 goals, which is pretty formidable. And before that, she's had, you know, over 100 appearances for Brescia and over 100 appearances for Torino. She scored 61 goals for the former and 27 for the latter. So she is a powerful forward. And as I said, you can't really discredit her abilities.
I'm just having a look at some of the comparisons that she's had to.
Serie A Female Footballer of the Year. She's won Serie A with Juventus, Coppa Italia.
Yep. She's been compared to a player like Ryan Giggs in the way she moves. And that is one of the best comparisons you can possibly have. And apparently as well, one thing we didn't see is she can hit a free kick and apparently can score some wonder goals. So if you're going to be watching Italy for the rest of the World Cup, keep an eye on her because if she can hit a goal from range, might be definitely on that highlight reel.
I think that Brazil-Italy game will be so intriguing to watch because we know the quality that Brazil also has with Cristiane, who scored a hat-trick. Mm-hmm. And what a hat-trick that was. But she couldn't have done it without her teammate Andressa, who set up 2 goals and provided those 2 assists for her. Brazil, what an opponent they will be.
It's going to be a big game.
They don't even have Marta at the moment, and they are still looking like a powerhouse.
They're always going to be a powerhouse, and they really played a great brand of football against Jamaica. Jamaica showed a bit, like that, she had a few chances, but Brazil being that experienced outfit with so many top quality players,
they're just technically amazing.
Look, you know what, this game against Australia is going to be massive because I think Brazil would love to be the team to drive the dagger deep into the Matildas' heart because of there's a lot of animosity, I feel. I feel it's probably one of Australia's great rivalries in women's football is this Australia-Brazil rivalry. We remember at the Olympics, I think it was a few years ago, when they played in Brazil and they went to penalties and there was a lot of controversy about the result. And Australia's gotten back at them. They've beaten them. This is going to be a really tasty outfit and game to watch because we maybe for those who haven't watched Brazil before, there might be some who want to get a bit of an idea of how good they are. They might think a lot about, are they like the men? Are they flashy? Are they quick? Are they pacey? they're going to be in for an absolute treat when you see them come up against the Matildas.
And you know what? I think that the battle will be won and lost in the midfield, because there is one defensive midfielder for Brazil who is 41 years old. Her name is Formiga, and she has appeared now at her seventh FIFA World Cup.
Is that a record?
It is a record.
Has to be.
Seventh FIFA World Cup.
160 caps for Brazil in 23 years. Unbelievable. And defensive mid as well. Jeez.
She's actually the only present player to feature in all Olympic Games tournaments of women's football since the first edition in 1996.
That is absolutely unreal. Unreal stats right there. Hats off to her. That's actually really cool stat. And she has TRC midfield as well, also plays for Milan. She's still playing for PSG for the bigger as well. So quite a high level for quite a big team. So exciting to see how that happens. We've had Ivan come through in the comments. Does Ange Postecoglou continue his good work at Yokohama or take the rumoured Greece job for international exposure and a potential move to a club at a top four European league after that? Ivan, you know what I reckon? He has to go to Europe. I reckon it is time for him to make that move and take the Greece job. Greece at the moment, and I know Athos Syriannis behind the glass, he's fuming at this result. They lost against Armenia this morning in a cutthroat qualifier at home. Now, Greece haven't qualified for the last two international tournaments, the Euros and the World Cup, and if they miss another one, the Euros in particular, where they're expected to be in a group where they could very well finish second. I know Italy, Greece, Bosnia, but they are more than capable of finishing second. You're not winning games at home against Armenia. There has to be questions asked, and they've got a good enough team to do so. But I think Ange Postecoglou has to be looked at to potentially take that role. But the worrying thing is, though, his football ideologies don't meet Greece's football ideologies of defence, 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 defence versus a very attacking football manager. So will they look for someone like that? Maybe. But I think Ange needs to make that move.
If he did move to Greece and to coach the Greek national team, do you think that he could potentially revive the national team?
No reason why not.
Do you think he might be able to tweak his own style to suit?
Well, Greece's greatest strength is their defence. And Ange Postecoglou is not going to go out there to defend. He's going to go out there to win and win big.
And win at all costs.
Of course. And right now, they need results. They need results.
Because where are they sitting in the European qualifying
in the group,
championship?
They are sitting, I believe that they're at a, they're, well, they're not.
Group
they're not,
J.
They're in Group J.
Fourth out of six teams.
And they're five points off second place Finland. And they don't even have the assurance of a playoff spot, regardless if they don't go through because of their Nations League finish. So it is second or bust.
So for those listening, Nick, just explain the process at the moment that they're going through. Because I think people might also be getting confused with the Nations League and how that kind of fits in. Those results fit in with the European qualifiers.
It is a very, very hard thing to wrap your head around. To sum it up in the best way possible, in the quickest way possible, at the moment it's European qualifiers for the Euros. The top two teams from each group advance, and there was the Nations League as well. So if you won your Nations League group, you basically have a second chance in the playoffs. So if, say, for instance, so looking at this right now in Group J, the two teams that finished top of their groups were Finland and Bosnia. So if Finland and Bosnia both don't go through, they get a second chance. If Finland go through, and that playoff spot will then go to third. So it sort of means that there could be a bit of luck. But regardless, looking at the group right now, if Finland were to finish second, it wouldn't even go to Greece. It would go to Armenia. Mm. So they need to put themselves in a position to at least be in a chance for a second chance. But they play Finland and they play Liechtenstein next. They've got to win both of those games. Otherwise, it's curtains.
And currently, Finland, as you touch on, are second.
Yeah.
And Liechtenstein are sixth, bottom of the group.
Haven't scored a goal. So if you're going to get a win,
it's against them.
Pile on the goals. Look, they're not going to finish top of the group. They're 8 points behind Italy. They're 5 points behind Finland. And that's already big enough of a gap. They would have loved, if they'd won this morning, they'd only be 2 points behind Finland. That just sums it all up. And to lose at home against Armenia, there's got to be some questions asked. Greece have some really top quality players. They've got guys like Kostas Manolas, Socrates Papastathopoulos in defence. They've got some really, really talented guys in Kostas Fortunis, Andreas Samaris. But unfortunately, they're not winning because of whatever reason, whether they're not getting along with the coach or whatever's going on. There's been rumours saying he's been done for ages. Ange could come in and potentially change that. And I think Greece need a potential change in the way they play their football. Because we'll talk to Vitor about this a little bit later. If what Italy have done really well is Italy were very much the same. Defensive-minded football. 1-0 wins are enough. 2-0 wins just do just enough to get over the line. Greece need to change that. They need to actually show a bit of vigour. Because when Italy's changed it, they're looking the best they've looked since they probably won the World Cup in terms of their attacking vigour. We haven't seen this for a very long time, and it's gotten a lot of the Italians really excited. So why not, you know, potentially just change this very...
Tweak it.
A little bit. Like, you still have good enough defenders to, you know, keep out the goals. Just trust in your attacking players to at least get those goals going back the other way, because they're good enough to beat most of these teams in this group. They're good enough to beat Bosnia. They're good enough to beat the rest, probably other than Italy. So if you want to get to a Euros and actually, because they don't want to miss a third big tournament in a row. Because how does that look for Greece? Because they're considered not a powerhouse, but they're considered at least, there's like an assurance to be at the Euros every time. Only 15 years ago, they won the Euros. So I think Ange could come in, and if that springboards him onto another big coaching job, that would be interesting. Because I think eventually I'd love to see an Australian coaching in the big four European leagues.
Oh, it would be.
And I think it's about time.
Amazing. Well, we do have one at the moment, Joe Montemurro with the women's game.
But obviously, if we can have Ange now potentially making that move as well.
Joining
if we have two, that'd be really exciting.
It would be. And I feel like I'm repeating myself on every show this week, the first three, that possession is no longer king. That game, Greece against Armenia this morning, Armenia defeated Greece, as you touched on, 3-2. Mm-hmm. Possession, though, was all in Greece's favour.
No shock.
75% to their 25%. Greece had more shots on target, more passes and more passing accuracy. Even though they had all of those stats that went in their favour, they could not get the 3 points. Now,
That's so frustrating.
I find it really fascinating because it's the way the game is shifting at the moment. Possession is no longer king.
No, it's redundant.
So it's about taking the chances that are presented to you and making the most of when they come about.
Of course, and they're not doing that. They still scored 2 goals, but if you can't keep them out the other way, and unfortunately, they were opened up with a very good defence that they have. They were still opened up, and I think that there's got to be questions asked about the coach, whether the players are motivated, whatever it might be. I don't want to speculate too much, but I think there has to be change for Greece. Running through some of the other results this morning in European qualifiers, there were some important results for some of the powerhouses. Belgium 3-0 over Scotland, Romelu Lukaku scoring a double and Kevin De Bruyne as well getting on the score sheet. Now, that's an example of dominant possession but winning games. When you have 72% possession but you're taking your chances with 25 shots, they put Scotland to the sword in very, very impressive fashion, putting themselves in a good position to qualify from the group.
And Lukaku showing that he can find the back of the
net. Can score.
But it is different. As we touch on, it's different when they're playing at club level and when they're playing for their country, which is,
it seems baffling,
but I can believe it.
France got back to winning ways. They lost against Turkey on the weekend, but they defeated Minos Andorra 4-0 on the road. And Mbappe, Ben Yedder, Florian Thauvin and Kurt Zouma all getting on the score sheet. Some new names in the French lineup in comparison to their World Cup team. And Ndombele, Ben Yedder, Thauvin, Dubois, Zouma, Lenglet and also Mendy all starting this game, trying for a bit of a new look with Didier Deschamps. They need to bounce back after losing against Turkey in the World Champions. Did exactly that. An impressive result nonetheless.
And talking about Turkey, Iceland defeated Turkey 2-1.
Yeah, that's a very important result. Ragnar Sigurdsson, not Gylfi, he scored a double, and that's an important win for Iceland. They're looking to get themselves back to the Euros. I saw a lot of people saying that Turkey were just a completely different outfit to what they showed against France and were beaten up by a very physical Iceland team.
And currently in Group H, France are on top. Turkey are second, would you believe? And Iceland are just on level points with them as well. So
I think they're in a good position, Turkey, because that win against France, and they're probably going to be wanting to definitely keep that one going. But Iceland, they're not going to make it easy for them. It's going to make things really exciting in that group over who potentially gets through. Turkey play Andorra and Moldova in their next two games, while Iceland, well, big games for them. Moldova and Albania, another team in Albania who were at the Euros last time around. They both avoid France, so it's big, big qualifiers, these ones here.
And it looks like between the second and third place, it'll come down to the tear breakers and that goal difference.
Yes, 100%. And Germany, 8-0 win over Estonia. Best way for them to send the statement. Marco Reus and Serge Gnabry with a goal each. And Leon Goretzka, Ike Gundogan, Timo Werner and Leroy Sané all getting on the score sheet. A new Germany side and an important 8-0 win to really send a statement that they're still ticking around.
Any surprises, though, that Germany are not top of their group? Northern Ireland take the cake on 12 points.
They've played one less game. Northern Ireland have played four, so probably that will change. Netherlands are also in that group. They've only played two games due to their Nations League commitments. Netherlands actually, surprisingly enough, already lost a game in this group against Germany in that 3-2 loss, which makes things rather interesting because Northern Ireland, as we did say, they beat Belarus this morning 1-0. Paddy McNair, former Manchester United man, getting on the score sheet, an important win for Northern Ireland nonetheless. Russia, 1-0 win over Cyprus. Good win for the former World Cup hosts. They're looking to continue their wave of momentum that they generated throughout the World Cup. They currently are sitting second behind Belgium, Kazakhstan and Scotland just behind them.
In Group I.
Yep. And some of the other big results this morning did say Italy 2-1 over Bosnia. They had to fight back from 1-0 down and Dzeko got Bosnia ahead before Lorenzo Insigne and Marco Verratti got two goals, which has put Italy in a really good position. And Bosnia, with still it all to be played for, they need to get results. It's very similar to Greece if they want to make up some ground. Hungary, 1-0 win over Wales. So Gareth Bale's Wales with a big setback, and Hungary looking to potentially draw a bit of a surprise in that group and look to qualify.
Wales look like they're not going through unless they, you know, put up some performances to turn it all around, because in Group E, Hungary are top of that group with Slovakia in second, followed by Croatia, Wales coming in at fourth, and Azerbaijan fifth. So they're going to have to do some bit of work to turn it all around.
As we did say, you look at when you look at Croatia as well, they're in a position they need to get themselves back out of the World Cup runners-up. They're in a bit of a stuttering phase at the moment, but I'm sure they'll still find a way to get through. Just running through quickly the other games from overnight. Slovakia 5-1 against Azerbaijan. Albania 2-0 over Moldova. Finland 2-0 over Liechtenstein. So they are all the big results. The next lot of European qualifiers will be in early September, so a big gap now until a bit of time for now. These players have a bit of R&R after a really long club season and now have a chance to rest heading into the new season. If you want to look forward to some of these games, just some of the pick of the bunch games I'm just scrolling through quickly. Ireland-Switzerland, that's shaping up to be a huge contest. Germany-Netherlands will meet again. That's going to be huge.
Massive.
Always is a big game when those two teams meet. Serbia-Portugal, France-Albania. We've got another contest between Finland and Italy, obviously the two top teams in that group. Northern Ireland, Germany, Scotland, Belgium meet once more. Poland, Austria, and we've also got a contest between England, also playing Kosovo, which is a first time matchup. So that will be another intriguing contest. It's getting nitty gritty now in those European qualifiers, but as we did say, a good chance for these players just to rest up a little bit because it's been a very, very long season.
Nick, we might take a quick break before we go to our guest.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
You're with Louise Taffer and Nick Dabano joining me here in the studio. And it's time to talk to Forza Italia's football podcast, Vito Doria, who joins us now. Vito, thank you so much for coming on the show.
No worries, Louise.
It's a pleasure to have you on. What a way for Italy to come back after 20 years not having appeared at the FIFA Women's World Cup and to get 3 points from their opening game.
Yeah, look, as a neutral, it was a fantastic game to watch. And the box for the Azzurri was a rather fantastic one. 2-1 win. Barbara Botnansea scored both goals, especially the 95th minute winner. So it's a positive start after such a long absence.
Vitor, it's Nick here. And were you at all surprised with the result, considering not many people knew too much about the Italian women's side, and considering that, as you did say, 20 years out in the wilderness?
Without going off on tangents or bringing up too many cans of worms at once or opening them, before Alan Stojic had got the sack from the Matildas job, I sort of thought that Australia had the chance to win the game rather convincingly. But once that scenario came up, I thought that might have made things a little bit easier on the Azzurri, and that was without having too much knowledge of the Italian squad prior to the tournament. But having to get to know some of the players, you know, so especially Bonansea and a few of her teammates who came from the championship-winning Juventus side, you know, just seeing the way they play as the game progressed, in a way, it kind of reminded me of the old Italian values from the men's side, you know, that defending well and hitting on the break and just exposing the space. So as the game went on, I thought, okay, looking at the final score, it's 2-1, but I felt that if Italy had released the ball quicker and they watched the offside positioning, I felt that Italy could have had a few more goals, and they did get some goals disallowed as well.
And how important, Vito, do you think it is that these big clubs in Serie A actually have women's teams?
Look, I think it's absolutely fundamental now, because in the past, well, women's football, I don't, to my knowledge, wasn't getting as much sort of investment or attention as it does now. But when you see clubs like Juventus and Fiorentina get involved, that's a big plus. And Brescia, they're a club that's becoming prominent in the women's game. And I think for them it's pretty good, because the men's side, they don't necessarily have a rich history, but the men's side have been involved in Serie A from time to time. But to jump on board and get involved in the ladies' game and help that develop, I think that's good for the women's game in Italy, but also good for Brescia as a club. It's more appeal to them.
Vito, just moving on quickly from the Women's World Cup, the men were in action over the past week in some European qualifiers against Greece and Bosnia. And one thing I saw in particular was that a real change in the style, the way that Italy had been playing, not so pragmatic and defensive, but also very attacking, something that we haven't seen from Italy in a very long time. What were your thoughts on these two qualifiers?
Very good results, and not just these two in general, but probably the last five or six or so under Roberto Mancini, Italy has been playing in a more attack-minded style. They're more fluid and they are more aesthetically pleasing. I reckon the turning point was that 1-0 defeat to Portugal in the Nations League last year, and it was a rather experimental-looking lineup. After that, that's when Mancini decided to have a more attack-minded midfield with that trio of Marco Verratti, Jorginho, and Nicolò Barella, and I think it's really benefited the team as well as the players. The players seem to be much happier in this attacking style. It's bringing out the best out of their attributes as well. And I hope this team, you know, they keep building on this path, and it just keeps knocking back all those old stereotypes and narratives that surround Italian football. You know, there is that attacking style. They can stay on their feet and, you know, just score as many goals as they possibly can.
And what are your thoughts on a player like Fabio Quagliarella being integrated back into the team? Obviously, he had one of his best ever, if not his best ever season at 36 years age. Can he go through to the Euros and really create something special for Italy, whether he be starting or coming off the bench, and play a big role for them? Obviously, considering time is not necessarily on his side.
Well, that's an intriguing case. I've been very happy with Quagliarella's form, and I think he deserves his selection for the national team, despite being 36 years old. My concern now, and it relates to his club form, is that his coach at Sampdoria, Marco Giampaolo, might not be there next season. And I think, depending on Giampaolo's replacement and how he sets up the team, it might impact on Quagliarella's form, it might not. If it doesn't impact on his form in a bad way and he can keep scoring, then perhaps he could play in that super sub role. And I think it's good to have those options, because Moise Keane is starting to emerge, but he's 19. And Andrea Bellotti had a good finish to the season with Torino, and he's about 25, 26. So when you have those options, and important things, if these players are in form, and if Quagliarella maintains his form as well, I think it's good that at least Mancini has those options. So he might have a certain striker he might prefer. Let's just say he goes with Keane this time next year and is informed. But if he's not firing, at least Quagliarella, with his experience and also his ability to provide some unpredictable and outrageous goals, I think it's good to have those extra avenues.
And Vitor, are there any players in your mind that you would like to see integrated back into the national team setup? I know Donnarumma was out with injury and Balotelli's been in and out of the team in a bit of a in the wilderness once again, even though he had a really solid end to the season at Marseille. Are there any others that you would like to maybe see get a crack over the next year heading into the Euros?
About returns, well, that's an intriguing case again because Donnarumma, I think, can do well, but it goes to show with Sirigu in form, you know, there's another competitor for his position. Pier Luigi Golini from Atalanta has been picked as well, and he had a good season with Ladea, helping them get into the Champions League, so he's another option. And Alex Meret, who plays for Napoli, he could be in the senior squad in the near future too. So I like Donnarumma, despite his flaws, but there's competition there, so he's got to definitely watch his back. Balotelli, he adds the X factor, but again, it's about having the consistency, being in the right frame of mind as well, and also, also gaining the trust of his teammates. I think that would be fundamental. So that's if we're talking about returns. As for new faces, a bit of a bias here, but the left back position, I would like to see Nicola Moro from my Sampdoria get a chance because I think he's actually improved a lot this season. So Emerson Palmieri from Chelsea played in place of the injured Cristiano Biraghi from Fiorentina and he did well, but I think the little competition always helps and I think Moro deserves a shot. If not, Leonardo Spinazzola had a good second half of the season with Juventus. So, again, it's always good if you have a bit of depth and you give the Mancini options.
And speaking of new faces, but switching to our youth national teams or the Italian youth national teams, Andrea Pinamonti scored 4 goals at the under-20 FIFA World Cup over there in Poland. What about him? Do you think that his amazing campaign might, you know, push him or propel him to maybe the national team or even a bigger club in Italy?
He is owned by Inter, but at the moment I can't see Antonio Conte giving him enough playing time next season. And I think he would be a waste on the Inter bench. So I would like to see him sent on loan to another club for a few months because he did play for Frosinone in the season that just went past, but he scored 5 or 6 goals in a team in which he was devoid of service. So maybe in a club like, say, Sassuolo, for instance, I think if he can go to a club like them, I reckon he could do pretty well. And then I've heard speculation he could be linked with Cagliari in a deal that might result in Nicolò Barella going to Inter, but they already have Leonardo Pavoletti as the centre-forward, and he gets called up to the Italian national side. And there's another young striker, Cagliari, called Alberto Cerri, who's been through the youth ranks in the Italy youth team. So I'm not sure where Pinamonti fits in there. But a mid-table provincial side could make room for him. And I think if given the right service, I think he could be another player that will have a breakthrough campaign in Serie A for 2019-2020.
Yeah, Vito, I have to agree. I've been very impressed with Pinamonti. We saw it in glimpses last year at Frosinone. But I think a team like a Sassuolo, even, you know, a Cagliari would even, if he does get those opportunities, you'd say Pavoletti is going to make it hard. Even one of those newly promoted outfits would do him well. The under-21 team, though, Vito, I had a look at their squad heading into the Euros and I was absolutely amazed at the talent that's out there. A lot of them already playing for the senior national team or getting regular club minutes. Is this arguably one of the best under-21 teams we've seen put on paper, probably since the 2013 team that made the final against Spain?
I reckon this is probably this team might even be a bit better than a 2013 side. And although Italy have won 5 under-21 titles, probably the best team Italy produced was the one that did not win it. And that was a bit before my time, the team that lost in 1986 to Spain. A lot of those guys went into the senior team that played at Euro 88 and Italia 90, where they were expected to win the tournament, but unfortunately finished third. But a lot of the stars of the Serie A from the 90s featured in that 1986 under-21 side. Going back to the recent era, I do think the 2019 side is better because a lot of them are getting that Serie A experience, and a lot of them are playing well in Serie A too. My only drawback about this team, my concern is the coach, Luigi Di Biagio, who's been there for 6 years, but they got knocked out in the group stage of the 2015 tournament, and they lost in the semis in 2017, and they were perhaps a little bit lucky to even make the semis in 2017. So with home advantage and these great players available, like there's Kane, there's also Riccardo Orsolini, who's a promising winger, and several others, Nicolò Zaniolo from Roma. The talent's there. It's just a matter if Di Biagio can fit the right players into his formation and if they perform. But he's also got to be able to make the right decisions on game day. If something's not right, he's got to make the right tactical tweaks or substitutions. And I'm not very confident in him, which is a shame because it would be great for this team to win in front of their home fans.
Vitor, just one final one before we let you go. How good is it as a whole, as being an Italian football fan, to see the four, obviously the four pillars, the two new youth teams, the women's team and the men's team, performing at such a level after what was rock bottom a couple of years ago after not qualifying for the World Cup?
Look, I think there are a lot of promising signs. I don't think Italian football is back just yet, because I think there are a lot of problems on and off the field, you know, with club level stuff, off the field. Now, Juventus winning the Serie A title comfortably and several other things. Stadiums, things like that. A lot of issues, clubs going bankrupt. So they're the negative aspects. But when you see these results from the international side, they do give you that glimmer of hope that maybe the dark times are over, or there are some redeeming features of Italian football that might help gain new supporters, and also for Italians to be proud of who they are, and also for the diaspora to keep an eye on the homeland of the parents and grandparents, that, you know, this country loves the football. They were a giant. There's been some uneasy times, but the foundation for probably a more promising future is there with the latest results, the senior squad, the under-20s doing well. Hopefully the under-21s can perform well. And even the women's side, which historically hasn't been that great, but it's a bright start to the World Cup. So with this sense of optimism, I don't want people to get carried away, but I'm really wanting this to be, like I was saying, the foundations for a far more prosperous future and for Italian football to really be respected and feared again. And also, hopefully, in a more positive sense, that positive style of play, and not be a begrudging respect, but really appreciate what they do and make people think, oh, wow, I want to be like them. I like what they're doing. I like that kind of philosophy and mentality as well.
Vito, thank you so much for joining us on Evenings on FNR, and we look forward to chatting to you again soon.
All right, thank you, Louise.
That was a pleasure. That was Vito Doria joining us there on Evenings on FNR. And Nick, that's all we've got time for today, but with the final 30 seconds, just one piece of transfer news here in Australia. Wellington Phoenix have signed their third of the season, that being Western Sydney Wanderers forward Josh Sotirio on a one-year deal. It seems that Ufuk Tale has a lot of rebuilding to do over there in Wellington. But as I said, Nick, thank you for joining me in the studio, and thank you for your company at home. If you've missed any of the show, head to FNR's website or FNR's SoundCloud. We'll see you again at the same time tomorrow. Bye for now.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.